Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on this radio program today, Google once again shows Apple which way is up. And no, Virginia, there is no Santa Claus. We imagine a world without holidays. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 13th of December. Good to have you with us. On the list of epic corporate failures this year, I don't think anything ranks as high as Apple's ill-fated map experiment. It's been 3 months or so since Google Maps, good old reliable Google Maps, was unceremoniously dumped from the new Apple operating system. But today, Google is back. A new map app for the iPhone, right at the top of the most downloaded list in the App Store. But I told you so's and bragging rights, sweet as they are just the smallest parts of Google's triumph, as Marketplace's Queena Kim explains.
You've heard the old adage, location, location, location. Well, in the age of mobile, you'll be hearing it a lot more. Ronald Goodstein is a marketing professor at Georgetown's business school.
The big growth in marketing now is locational-based marketing on your mobile. And Google earns about 97% of its revenues through its advertising.
And with its new iPhone app, it has the potential to make more. After all, half the U.S. smartphone users are on iPhones. And unlike the previous Google Maps, Google can advertise on its new version.
It's 12 o'clock, and I'm on 95 South heading down to Florida. Well, here's the restaurant you may want to stop at.
Google Maps might also serve up ads for hotels and fruit stands. We're not there yet, but analysts believe this scenario will unfold in the not-too-distant future. But Google's scoring another win, and that's in the court of public opinion. Colin Gillis is an analyst at BGC Partners.
Apple makes great products, but in terms of their software development, they're not the best.
Gillis says Apple's map fiasco is reinforcing an emerging narrative that Google is a king of mobile software. And for the first time in recent memory, Georgetown's Goodstein says you're starting to see a slight crack in Apple loyalty.
Loyal Apple users want the Apple hardware, but now they're willing to compromise on the software.
And if Apple has more failures, that crack could turn into a fault line. I'm Queena Kim for Marketplace.
All right, on now to the most exciting phrase in the economic policy debate currently taking up all the oxygen in Washington, D.C. It is chained CPI, or chained consumer price index. It's a slightly different way to measure inflation. And no, honestly, it's not that exciting. And most of the people in Washington, yes, who are using it are hardcore policy wonks. But it matters because it may well be a key, the key perhaps, to solving the fiscal cliff. Marketplace's Mark Garrison takes it from there.
How can I explain when there are few words I can choose?
Erasure got nearly 4 minutes to sing about chains of love, but I only get 90 seconds to explain chained CPI, but it's doable. The CPI measures the price of various goods over time, but it doesn't really account for how humans behave when prices go up. Sometimes they buy less of stuff that gets more expensive. For example, the CPI tracks beef and pork prices. I talked to Kathy Griffin at Topps Barbecue in Memphis, which sells both. She loves brisket, but if the price got too high,
I would probably buy the pork because it was less expensive.
Chain CPI accounts for this, what economists call the substitution effect. The simple act of switching the way we measure inflation could save hundreds of billions of dollars. That's because chained CPI is lower than the benchmark CPI. If life really isn't as expensive as we thought, the government doesn't have to pay as much in benefits. But one powerful lobby thinks this is a raw deal. Christina Martin-Fervita is with the AARP.
That money would come straight out of the pockets of individuals who are already retired.
The seniors' interest group has a flotilla of lobbyists fighting this idea, arguing chained CPI is unfair to older Americans because their high medical costs aren't factored in. You don't need to kidnap Nate Silver to know that older people vote. So even if chained CPI saves big money on paper, the politics is a lot trickier. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Wonder if Nate Silver's going to hear this. Who knows? This was not a happy day on Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. been an eventful couple of weeks in the world of ground transportation, cars for hire specifically, and a little company called Uber. It makes an app that lets customers summon and pay for a car service electronically. 5 minutes or less is the idea. Uber's got branches in New York, San Francisco, Washington, D.C., and Los Angeles, and therein lies at least part of the problem. Because in some of those cities, Uber has been less than warmly received by the existing taxi establishment. Last week, though, Washington and today New York agreed to let apps be used to get yourself a ride. Travis Kalanick is the CEO of Uber. Welcome to the program.
Hey, good to be here.
You're known and your business is known for doing something first, for taking action first, getting your service up and running first, and then seeking permission from regulators later. And I wonder what it would be like if everybody did that.
That's an interesting question. We don't really go to regulators and ask for permission. What we do is we take a look at the regulations in a particular city. We take a look at the existing laws, and if we see that we're legal, we move forward. And the reason why is if you put yourself in the position of asking for permission, the powers that be are going to make sure you never roll out, regardless of whether it's legal.
Do you guys go in and get business licenses before you hire your first cab and car?
Oh, of course. And to be clear, we partner with existing sedan companies. So the way it all works is you push a button on your phone, but what Uber is doing is connecting you to your legal, licensed, regulated transportation providers in your city and just making sure you get connected to the closest one. And when we go into a city, when we're rolling out, we get the appropriate licenses and we move forward.
All right. So tell me how you split up the proceeds on an Uber transaction. Who gets how much money?
Well, there's a couple different models we do, but typically the driver basically the sedan company that we're working with gets 80% of the proceeds. We get 20%.
It's not bad.
Yeah, not a bad situation. You go to a lot of cities around the country where the driver is getting 30%.
It's fair to say, I think, that you guys have run into a whole bunch of resistance in a lot of cities. And I wonder what it is, in your mind, about taxi and limousine commissions in all these various cities that makes them so reluctant to sort of experiment, I guess.
Well, I think what it is, when you're coming up with a new alternative for transportation, there's going to be incumbent players, like the taxi industry, that are very nervous, a little worried about new technology and how that might change the landscape for their industry. And so quite often we find that the taxi industry is lobbying city governments as well as regulators to try to slow us down or even kick us out of the city. And it's often that kind of sort of protectionism can often lead to really poor service, which is why in so many cities across the country, taxi service is so poor.
Where do you live in San Francisco, right?
Yeah, I live in San Francisco, but given all the cities we're rolling out, I don't get to see home as often as I'd like.
Yeah. How do you get around town?
I mean, that's I'm Uber's biggest customer. Let's just put it that way.
Travis Kalanick, he is the co-founder and CEO of Uber. Travis, thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you.
Hurricane Sandy apparently didn't do too much to dampen enthusiasm among consumers. The Commerce Department reported this morning that retail sales last month were higher than a year ago, driven in large part by a jump in online sales. That last bit is great news, says commentator Robert Reich. Not especially in keeping with the spirit of the season, though, is it?
The essence of gift giving is not just the gift itself, but also the effort that goes into it. Few of us have the time or skill to make a gift from scratch, but we used to, at least, spend days finding just the right token of our affection. Not long ago, holiday shopping entailed traipsing from one store to another with our list of loved ones, ducking crowds, sorting through items, standing in line at cash registers. And then once we found the gifts, we had to lug them home, find the right wrapping paper and a suitable ribbon, and then there was the whole process of putting the wrapped gift into the mail or even delivering it in person. The entire enterprise required lots of time, lots of effort and thought. It was hard work. That's what gift-giving was all about. But online shopping is displacing all of this. Minimum effort is the selling point for online retailers who now ask little of the giver beyond naming a price range, typing in an address, and then offering a credit card. Presto, it's done. Someone I know boasts she did her Christmas shopping online in less than an hour. But wait, if thoughtfulness and effort are a big part of the value of a holiday gift, then almost effortless holiday shopping contradicts the whole meaning and spirit of the exchange. Packages zip directly from the gift giver's point and click to computerized warehouses and to recipients without any evidence of human intervention, let alone personal effort. I've already received two holiday gifts whose givers weren't even identified, and another from someone whose name appears on an impersonal printout that looks like a laundry ticket. Now, call me old-fashioned, but I think we're losing something here. The thought behind the gift is as important as the thing being given. But we've automated and depersonalized gift-giving to the point where what's being given is just a thing without much of a thought.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His most recent book is called Beyond Outrage. Coming up.
I'm sure that bad Christmas music would entirely evaporate.
The upsides and the downsides of a world without holidays. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, it's been a while, but today we do deliver the sad music. The Dow Industrials gave up 74 points, down 0.5%, closed at 13,170. The NASDAQ off 21.7%, 29.92 the number. The S&P 500 snipped off 9 points, almost 2/3%, finished at 14.19. Citigroup and Bank of America both subtracted 2/3%. J.P. Morgan Chase was basically flat today. Among the other losers, ExxonMobil down 1% and Boeing dropped nearly 1.5%. That new Google Maps for iPhone app directed Google shares up 0.75%. Apple went the wrong way by about 1.75%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.73%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Friday. Did consumers pay more or less for stuff like food, gas, and clothing in November? The Labor Department releases the Consumer Price Index. The Federal Reserve issues its monthly industrial production report. And get ready for the Christmas bird count. Every year, volunteers across the country actually go out and count our feathered friends. The data reveals the health of our bird population. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Brits have been letting off a little bit of steam today over a subject we are getting ever more familiar with over here, fracking for natural gas. The government in London has given the go-ahead to resume test drilling for shale gas, tests that were stopped last year after they apparently triggered two small earthquakes. From London Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Britain's embattled finance chief, George Osborne, sees shale gas as a lifeline. He told Parliament that Britain should follow the US example and get fracking.
We don't want British families and businesses to be left behind as gas prices tumble on the other side of the Atlantic.
Britain's supplies of natural gas from the North Sea are running down. The UK currently imports most of what it needs. In 20 years, it'll probably have to import all of it. Energy adviser Dan Lewis says the UK faces a simple choice over its gas.
Do we want to buy it in from abroad at a premium, or do we want to develop our own and get some tax revenue, some jobs, and help some of the parts of the country that really could do with quite a boost?
And he dismisses the two earthquakes triggered in Britain by fracking.
They're so small that no one could actually feel them. Not a single teacup was broken.
To the UK!
No fracking!
I can't hear you!
No fracking!
But anti-fracking protesters also point to cases of water pollution in the United States. And Helen Rimmer of Friends of the Earth argues that shale is a dangerous distraction.
We need to be reducing our reliance on gas and fossil fuels and developing our clean, renewable energy resources. And that would not only cut carbon emissions, but could create thousands of new jobs across the UK.
The environmental hazard and the economic benefits of fracking in Britain will likely pale in comparison with those in the US, where recoverable shale gas reserves are 40 times the size of Britain's. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Advertising Age magazine is out with its annual top 10 list of most viral online ad campaigns. On the list are some you might expect. There was a Samsung ad with LeBron James in it, and that Kony video about child soldiers in Uganda that was such a big deal for a time. There is some serendipity in going viral, to be sure. Also, some strategy, too, as Marketplace's Dan Bobkoff tells us.
If the makers of Angry Birds had wanted 100 million people to see a TV ad for the game, it would have cost dearly.
They would be looking at around $20 million.
Tales Teixeira studies viral marketing at Harvard Business School. Instead of paying millions, game maker Rovio made perhaps the dorkiest viral video ever. It shows a scientist on the International Space Station doing some physics demonstrations
that involve some of the things you might see in the Angry Birds game.
109 million views later, that's enough for the number three spot on this year's top 10 viral campaigns.
When your content is great, your fans actually distribute it for you.
Michael Learmonth is with Advertising Age. He says while the top video in 2011 got about 65 million views, this year's winner, that campaign about Joseph Kony, got over 213 million.
It just shows you when the idea is powerful enough, the web works.
Before this year, advertisers might put an ad up online only after it aired on TV. Now campaigns kick off online. This 90-second Samsung spot mocking Apple iPhone fanboys racked up nearly 72 million views.
I heard the connector is all digital.
What?
What does that even mean?
Who knows?
What makes an ad go viral? Novelty helps, something people want to share. Marketers have been known to even pay bloggers to generate buzz. But Harvard professor Teixeira says there's still one wild card.
Above all, it's still luck.
But marketers are learning fast how to engineer viral marketing success. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
There's been so much news of state budget cuts the past couple of years. Education, in particular, of tuition increases and cuts in services. It's come almost to be the norm, which is why an item right here in Los Angeles caught our eye today. David Geffen of Hollywood and the entertainment world has given UCLA's medical school $100 million to fully fund the education of about 30 new doctors every year. UCLA Chancellor Gene Block is the guy on the receiving end of that check. Welcome to the program.
It's wonderful to be here.
This is not David Geffen's first gift to UCLA. He's been heavily involved, as of course you know, with the university. What was the process like to bring this one to closure?
This was really David's idea. It was his inspiration. You know, for a while, I think he's been thinking about how he could make it easier for our medical students to graduate and pursue their passions without worry about acquired debt. So this was really his vision. He brought it to us. And we are eternally grateful for his support. You know, he's had a huge impact on this school now for years, and this is just such a special opportunity for our students.
And the key thing is here that it is for the students, right? This is all scholarship money. Do I have that right?
Exactly. This is focused. This is $100 million focused on scholarships to allow the best and the brightest students to come to UCLA, receive their medical education, leave debt-free, and then really pursue the types of careers, medical careers, that they most want to pursue without having to consider having to pay back loans.
Well, and let's explain why that's relevant, right? Because a lot of brand-new doctors choose specialties that will be more remunerative because they've got $100-something, $200,000 in debt.
Exactly. And that's, you know, it's still wonderful. We have highly talented physicians in all areas, all specialties. That's very important. But it's also important to have some students that really can freely make that decision if they want to practice as a, you know, in a rural area. They can feel free to do that. They don't have to, again, worry about paying back debt. So I think it allows some of our most creative students an opportunity to do good in new and important ways because of their freedom from having any, say, acquired loans.
You guys are kind of betting on the come, though, on this, right? Because there's no requirement that students go into, you know, needy specialties once they graduate with these scholarships.
Yeah, I mean, this gives students a full set of opportunities. That's really, I think, what David wanted. He wanted them to really leave with the whole world in front of them as an opportunity. And it's up to them ultimately to decide where they want to practice and how they want to practice. We're confident they will do the right thing and they'll make a difference in people's lives throughout the country, actually throughout the world.
This is not an easy time to be in higher education in the state of California, as you, among probably a handful of people, know better than anybody else. Is this the way forward in higher education in this state and across the country as state budgets get tighter and things become more difficult?
You're exactly right. I mean, in many cases, private philanthropy has helped to make up the loss of state support and, importantly, provided the additional funds to really do the dazzling things that universities are capable of doing. I know that David hopes that this will set an example for others to sort of follow suit and help additional students. And it represents such an important example of how a dedicated private individual who's a visionary in his philanthropy can make a difference and hopefully inspire others to make a difference.
Let me ask you this. What do you think of the new logo?
Oh, the new logo. Yeah. It's controversial. It's controversial.
I'll let you get away with that. Gene Block, he's a chancellor at UCLA. If you want to see that logo, by the way, we'll have it on our website. Thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you.
Let me take a second and get a little dystopian on you here. What if there were no holidays and no holiday shopping? I know that thought has crossed your mind, stuck in the crowded parking lot of a department store while yet another terrible Christmas song plays on the radio. Sometimes it does all seem like it's more trouble than it's worth, but I'm not just talking about Christmas. You know, I'm talking about all of them. Marketplace's David Weinberg went in search of a future without holidays.
The first place I went on my quest was the streets of Los Angeles. I asked people if they would miss the holidays if they suddenly vanished. Most people said, not really. So if the holidays went away, you wouldn't be sad by that?
No.
Is this your son?
That is my son.
Do you think he would miss the holidays?
Yeah, ask him.
Would you miss Christmas and Hanukkah if it went away?
Yes, a little bit.
I get all these things.
Yes, Americans love to buy things during the holidays.
As retailers call them, consumer holidays, you know, everything from St. Patrick's Day to Hanukkah and Christmas are big business for retailers.
Kathy Granis is a spokesperson for the National Retail Federation. She says retailers have found a way to market products for every occasion, from costumes at Halloween to green beads on St. Patrick's Day. So what would happen to our economy if that sudden burst of holiday shopping were to vanish under mysterious circumstances?
I think if we were to adjust to a pattern where holidays were outlawed, we would probably consume as much goods and services, but it's just going to be a very different mix.
Michael Hicks is the director of the Center of Business and Economic Research at Ball State. He says without the holidays, the labor market would see a lot less temporary hires, and there are certain products that might go away for good.
I'm sure that bad Christmas music would entirely evaporate, which may not be a bad thing.
Who's got a big red cherry nose?
Santa's got a big red cherry nose.
Who laughs this way? Oh.
Would the world be a darker place without Bob Dylan's bizarre polka version of It Must Be Santa?
Special night, yeah, that's right. Must be Santa, must be Santa, must be Santa, Santa Claus.
Maybe not, but all the royalties from that album went to charity, and that, says Michael Hicks, would be hard to replace.
And I'm not sure there is anything like the holiday season for opening people's pocketbooks to charity.
And without the holidays, you might not get a tactical tomahawk.
We're giving people things like tactical tomahawks.
Wait, what's a tactical tomahawk?
A tactical tomahawk is a tomahawk designed for fighting the zombie apocalypse off.
Will Akerlof is president of Liquid Advertising. His clients include brands in the entertainment industry. And this year, as a thank you to those clients, he's sending them tomahawks.
This is kind of an example of inefficient corporate giving that probably would be redirected towards other more productive parts of the economy, should we not engage in it.
If it weren't for holidays, he might not be able to afford tomahawks.
We have a lot of clients that will say, we want a Christmas ad campaign, we want a holiday ad campaign, we want a Q4 campaign, we want a spring campaign that kicks off just before Easter.
But even if the calendar had no holidays, Akerlof has no doubt that consumer holidays, like life itself, would find a way.
Yeah, there would be an opportunity for a sale, and it would be, you know, the start of March would be a sale, and it would eventually probably turn into something exactly like a holiday anyway. It would, we'd have just start of March parades and start of March sales and start of March cards to give out.
This holiday season, celebrate the true meaning of start of March! With the incredible deals on all your flooring needs at Linoleum City, price and participation may vary.
I know it's only December, so let me be the first to wish you and yours a very merry start of March. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, in which you are asked to decide what the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, NASA, and something called the Surface Transportation Board all have in common. You're never going to get it, so I'll just tell you. They are the three top places to work in the federal government when you break it down by small, medium, and large agencies. The losers are the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, the Broadcasting Board of Governors, go figure that one out, and the Department of Homeland Security. We've got a link to the annual Best Places to Work in Government survey on our website. It's marketplace.org. And with that, we're done. That's Marketplace from American Public Media this Thursday. Today, the Dow gave up 74 points, down 0.5%. The NASDAQ lost 21.7 tenths% there. The S&P 500 snipped off 9 points, almost 2/3%. John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The acting managing editor around here is Ethan Lindsay. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.